You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 30th. I'm Morgan from Drake University, and here's our first story. Rails West Museum to expand scope. And this is written by Scott Stewart of the Nonpareil. The story of Council Bluffs is inextricably linked to the railroad, but the community's history extends beyond the tracks and locomotives that built its foundation. The Historical Society of Pottawatomie County wants to tell the rest of the story of the community's history, which is why it's looking to expand the scope of Rails West Museum to encompass more Council Bluffs history that goes beyond the railroad. We have amazing things in our archives. There are amazing things in the city that we want to start showing, said Kat Slaughter, director of Rails West Museum, which is operated by the Historical Society of Pottawatomie County. We're not going to stop showing railroad history, but Council Bluffs is railroad history. That's why Council Bluffs was built and how it's grown over the years, so we really want to show how those pieces all come together. The museum announced its planned tradition through a Giving Tuesday live stream on the Society's Facebook page, which remains available at facebook.com/thehistoricalsociety. Slaughter said the archives include a lot of family history that's been donated over the years, and there's also material about hotels, restaurants, theaters, and other spaces that existed in Council Bluffs' history. We wouldn't necessarily connect directly, but is absolutely a result of the railroad coming to town. A future exhibit is in the design stage, Slaughter said, with the hope of having it ready for public display by the spring. Union Pacific Railroad Museum, located just north of the Rails West Museum, donated display cases to assist with the effort. We're going to be doing a lot of our displays, Slaughter said. It's a perfect time to bring those other pieces out of the archive. Rails West would welcome volunteers to assist with the transformation and monetary support. The focus of the Giving Tuesday 712 campaign efforts would be most appreciated. The money, of course, is extremely helpful, Slaughter said. The people are also what we need to work on all the projects. So we're going to be cleaning, we're going to be reorganizing, we're going to be taking stuff out of the archives. Literally moving the display cases into position takes a team of people. The museum is open to the public on Saturdays during the winter months. And once a month, we'll be coordinating its volunteers and board members to work on adjusting the display space into the new configuration. Anyone interested in helping can reach out to the museum or follow facebook.com/railswestmuseum for updates. We do want to take a few more days during our days off to do some of the bigger projects in here where we're going to make a big mess, Slaughter said. We'll be back to our regular hours by the end of March. While the museum is not looking for donations of artifacts, Slaughter said, residents are welcome to donate copies of photos that may be of interest for inclusion into its collection. The museum would scan a digital copy, which it can make available for the photo's owner, too. Slaughter said the museum also wants feedback. What do you want to see in your Council Bluffs Museum? This isn't ours. This is everybody's place. Beyond the museum, the Historical Society also offers regular lectures in the broader community, as well as a podcast and other ways to access local history. Those can be found through its website, thehistoricalsociety.org. And there are three images associated with this story today. The first one is of two men looking at a computer, and the caption says, "A Facebook live stream out of the Rails West Museum in Council Bluffs shares the stories of some of the artifacts in the collection of the Historical Society of Pottawatomie County on Tuesday, November 28th, 2023. The next image is of the interior of the museum, and it says, "The interior of the Rails West Museum will be reimagined this winter with plans for a new exhibition open to the public sometime in the spring." And the third image is black and white, and it shows some trains, and the caption says, "The Rails West Museum is located in the former Rock Island Depot and has a collection of locomotives and train cars outside the museum." All right, the next story is titled, "Community Foundation for Western Iowa Celebrates Support Shown Tuesday." The subheadline is Giving Tuesday 712, and this is written by the nonpareil without a author specified. From right, okay, so there's an image and it shows five people holding up a sign that says Give Today, and those people from right to left are Community Foundation for Western Iowa Finance Manager Kathy Wright, President and CEO Donna Dostal, Community Partnerships Manager Katrina Tribal, Marketing and Engagement Manager Rachel Moorhead, and Vice President of Operations Kelly Dix posed for a photo holding fund signs during a Giving Tuesday 712 celebration at its foundation headquarters on Tuesday, November 28th, 2023. Giving Tuesday was celebrated across the country, and the Community Foundation was at the center of the festivities. The foundation hosted a gathering at its East Broadway offices where community members and nonprofit leaders gathered to celebrate the day. Bonus contributions were also awarded to 13 different area nonprofits that were nominated by local businesses and community members. All right, and moving on to the next story, it is titled Neola Holler Find Again. And Neola is spelled N-E-O-L-A. And this is written by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A Southwest Iowa company that transports and disposes partially digested food from the stomachs of slaughtered animals was recently fined again for improperly spreading the material on fields, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Feedlot Service Company of Neola and its owner, Fred Roan, agreed this month to pay a $7,000 fine for disposing of the material on terrain that is too hilly and too close to a water well, a recent DNR order said. It's the second time in about 2 years that the department fined the company. The company operates an open cattle feedlot with about 1,500 animals, but also hauls paunch manure from a cattle slaughterhouse in Omaha, Nebraska, DNR records show. The paunch manure is extracted from the digestive tracts of slaughtered animals and has historically been treated as a waste product, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Cows often contain about 50 pounds of partially digested food. In recent years, some have sought to use it as feed, compost, or to produce biofuels. Feedlot Service Company spreads it on fields where it decomposes. It is considered a solid waste in Iowa. Roan told the Iowa Capital Dispatch that he hauls paunch from the Omaha facility almost daily, stockpiles it, and periodically applies it to land to help enrich the soil. He said some who live nearby do not like the smell of it and are quick to complain to the DNR. The company was fined $9,000 in 2021 after the DNR received several complaints about those field applications, including that there were parts of animals in addition to the stomach contents. During the investigation, I observed numerous dead animal parts, including cow hooves, bellies, hearts, hides, tails, chunks of flesh, bones, other unknown parts of animals, and other forms of solid waste items, said Allison Manns, a senior environmental specialist for the DNR, writing in a March 2021 investigative report. It's illegal in Iowa to dispose of human carcasses or their parts by strewing them across fields. Roan told the DNR it was an isolated incident in his more than 30 years of hauling paunch that was caused by a confluence of factors, including changes at the slaughterhouse and his company's failure to fully inspect what it was hauling, DNR records show. He produced a stack of receipts to show that he had routinely disposed of animal parts at a landfill. But the DNR noted several other violations, including applying too much paunch manure to the fields and in places that were too hilly or close to drinking water wells. The department also found that contaminated water from paunch manure and cattle manure at the feedlot had flowed into a nearby creek. In a September 2021 agreement with the DNR, Roan did not admit wrongdoing but agreed to pay the fine, comply with state rules, and keep better documentation of the material he hauls and applies. However, in February 2023, someone made an anonymous complaint to the DNR that the company had again spread paunch on hilly terrain and too close to a well. The department's subsequent investigation confirmed that and noted Ponch in a roadside ditch and along the embankment of the nearby creek. The inadequate application and management depict a lack of consideration for the environment, according to a recent DNR order. Evidence was observed that Ponch manure had migrated to the water's edge of Keg Creek. Rowan told Capital Dispatch he erred by spreading Ponch slightly too far onto more steeply sloped ground, but said the well had been abandoned and shouldn't be concerned for contamination. As part of the order, Rowan again didn't admit to wrongdoing, but agreed to abide by state regulations and pay a $7,000 fine, which Rowan described as the cost of doing business in an interview. He said passerby who see potential violations should contact him instead of the DNR so he can fix the problems without an investigation and fines. Those administrative fines are capped at $10,000 by state law. Higher amounts can be sought in court. All right, the next story is titled Lincoln Police Release Name for Officer Involved Shooting. And this is written by Alex Vargas of the Lincoln Journal Star. The Lincoln Police Department released the name of the officer who shot a 35-year-old man last week after police say the man drove his Jeep toward the officer. Officer Nicholas Vest shot into Garrett Hanika's vehicle November 21st in the parking lot of the Microtel Inn and Suites at 2505 Fairfield Street in Lincoln, Nebraska. Vest has 7 years of law enforcement experience and has been with the department since July 2021. Hanika has been a suspect in a stolen firearms case out of Council Bluffs, police said last week. Vest followed Hanika into the hotel parking lot, pulled his cruiser behind Hanika's Jeep, and got out to make contact when Hanika began to reverse his car into the cruiser, acting police chief Mitchin Morrow said. Hanika then accelerated toward Vest, which prompted him to shoot twice at the vehicle. Vest hit Hanika twice, once in the head and once in the lower body, Morrow said. He was treated for his injuries at a local hospital and lodged at the Lancaster County Jail in Lincoln on suspicion of first-degree assault, attempted first-degree assault on an officer, use of deadly weapon to commit a felony, and resisting arrest with a deadly weapon. A 39-year-old woman was a passenger in Hanika's vehicle. After he backed his Jeep into the cruiser, she tried to exit the vehicle and was run over. She was taken to a local hospital where she continues to receive treatment for non-life-threatening injuries. Vest remains on administrative leave while the police department investigates the shooting, which is standard practice. All right, the next story is titled Harrison County Seeks Tips on Missing Person, written by Scott Stewart of the Nonpareil. Jesse George wasn't with friends and family this Thanksgiving. George, a Missouri Valley resident, has been missing since June 28th, according to a news release from Harrison County Crime Stoppers. Stacy Salter, a board member for the group, said investigators have limited the information that can be publicly disseminated about the case. George was last seen during the early morning hours of Wednesday, June 28th, near a residence on 4th Street in Missouri Valley. He didn't have a vehicle, but he did have access to a small motorbike he used to get around time. He wasn't employed at the time of his disappearance. George is 36 years old, weighs about 270 pounds, and is 6 foot 1 inch tall. He has brown hair and brown eyes. He has tattoos on his right arm. Find more information or leave a tip at harrisoncountyiowacrimestoppers.org/jesse-david-george. The citizens-based Crime Stoppers group reformed earlier this year after being dormant due to a lack of participation. It is independent of the National Crime Stoppers USA group and the Harrison County Sheriff's Office. It offers cash rewards for anonymous tip. It's a way for the community to get together to share what they're seeing, Harrison County Sheriff's Officer Sergeant Todd Denton told the Nonpareil earlier this year. The next story is titled, Study Shows Subsidizing Doctor Travel May Improve Rural Access, and it is written by Brooklyn Drazy of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. As Iowa faces workforce shortages in nursing and other areas, a new University of Iowa professor-led study has shed light on a possible tool to combat predicted losses in rural specialty healthcare. The study found that providing a subsidy to cardiologists for their travel to rural areas would help maintain necessary healthcare access as the number of specialists leaving the practice outpaces those entering. The study was conducted by University of Iowa marketing professor Tom Gruka, University of Oxford, Associate Professor Jason Bell, and Arizona State University Assistant Professor Sang-Hak Lee. You can't just wish and hope that suddenly the magic cardiology fairy will invent a bunch of cardiologists. That's not going to happen, Gruka said. So we have to be proactive and start thinking about what is facing our state as a whole, especially the rural areas, and we have to do something about it now before it happens, because once it happens, there's not some quick fix. Gruka said that there are just under 200 cardiologists practicing in Iowa, almost all based in urban areas. Nationally, about 2,000 cardiologists are leaving the practice due to retirement or other reasons every year, with about 1,500 graduates entering into the job field annually, leaving unfilled positions. The number of cardiologists in the U.S. is predicted to decline by as much as 10% in coming years, and rural areas will see the most impact, Gruka said. In Iowa, specialists utilize visiting consulting clinics to teach rural residents, but traveling can be costly and time-consuming for the in-demand physicians. The study looked into how to maintain the level of care given to Iowans across the state. With these numbers in mind, and figuring out how to encourage specialists to continue practice in visiting counseling clinics. The pullback is not going to be in cities necessarily. The pullback in care is going to be in rural areas, Gruka said. This is just to keep the level of healthcare access where it is. Otherwise, it's going to shrink and shrink, and when people have to travel too far to get care, they put it off and bad things happen. Researchers looked at solutions developed by other countries to see what would work in the rural U.S. Australia turned out to be dealing with the same issues as Iowa. The country has employed two policies, hiring physician specialists from out of the country, which Gruka said wouldn't be helpful here, and paying doctors for their travel to rural areas to provide care. Researchers found it would cost $430,000 a year, or about $80 for each visiting clinic day, to maintain the level of care that was present in 2019 as cardiologists retire or leave. They used Carver College of Medicine data and developed a mathematical formula to see how much it would cost to fund doctor travel to outside clinics, Gruka said, assuming physicians get paid nothing to travel. What sounds like a really big number, but is That sounds like a really big number, but it really isn't, compared to hiring just one cardiologist to try to boost health care in the state. They cost a lot of money, Gruka said. So this would be kind of a system-wide solution, and it would restore access and keep access in all the different cities that are currently enjoying that improved access in their own hometowns. The subsidy would pay cardiologists per minute for their travel, which Gruka said can be seen as lost time and money due to their inability to work while driving. Paying them for their travel could make it easier for them to travel more, helping in keeping the state level in terms of care. Gruka said the study didn't dive into who would pay this subsidy, whether it's through employers, insurance companies, or the state or federal government. Instead, it focused on the fact that it must be done if Iowans are going to continue having access to necessary health care. The Visiting Consultant Clinic Network has worked for decades, but as the number of cardiologists decreases with fewer people to fill the gaps, Gruka said more needs to be done to keep the network running in the future. Just because something's gone on forever doesn't mean it's going to keep going on, Gruka said. We have to take some steps to look at what's happening, project what's going to happen to the future, and then make sure that people who live in rural areas have equitable access to healthcare. The next story is titled All Care Offers COVID-19 Clinic on Saturday. All Care Health Clinic will offer a COVID-19 vaccination clinic on Saturday, December 2nd. The healthcare's pharmacy will offer shots from 8 to 11 a.m. during regular hours at All Care's 902 South 6th Street location, according to a news release. Flu shots will also be available for those who want both vaccinations. Patients and community members attending the clinic should bring their insurance information, if available. Most insurers will cover the cost of the vaccine and administration of the dose. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that those 5 years or older get an updated COVID-19 vaccine, regardless of whether they've received any original COVID-19 shots. The walk-in immunization event is supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration's 2023 COVID-19 bridge funding that sustains fair access to COVID-19 testing, vaccination, and treatment. The next story is titled, Iowa Lottery Error Yields Prizes for Wrong Numbers, and this is by the Associated Press. Powerball losers in Iowa were actually winners for about 7 hours this week after the state's lottery mistakenly posted the wrong winning numbers for the game. Lottery officials blamed an unspecified human reporting error for the wrong numbers being posted for Monday night's Powerball drawing. The incorrect numbers were posted on the Iowa Lottery's website about 12:30 a.m. Tuesday, and it took until 7:15 a.m. before anyone noticed the mistake, took the numbers down, and halted payoffs. The lottery said the initial incorrect numbers would have resulted in prizes ranging from $4 to $200. Officials didn't specify how many people won. Anyone who got up early and cashed in a winning ticket will be able to keep the money. Monday night's Powerball jackpot was for an estimated $355 million. The lottery had to work until 3:30 p.m. Tuesday to correct its system and resume cashing winning Powerball tickets. With the correct numbers, 3,998 people who bought Powerball tickets in Iowa won prizes, also from $4 to $200. The next story is titled, Iowa LGBTQ Students Sue Over New State Law. Law restricts school books, students' preferred pronouns. Written by Aaron Murphy of the Lee Gazette Des Moines Bureau. 7 Iowa students are named as plaintiffs in a federal lawsuit filed Tuesday that challenges a new sweeping state law that places restrictions on LGBTQ students and school materials. The ACLU of Iowa joined 2 law firms in filing a lawsuit challenging Iowa Senate File 496, which prohibits the instruction of gender identity and sexual orientation through 6th grade, prohibits books with descriptions of sex acts, and requires parental notification when a K-12 students want to be referred to by a different pronoun or name in school. The law was passed by Republican state lawmakers and signed into law in May by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. The lawsuit asks the court for an immediate halt to enforcement of the law during the legal challenge. Attorneys said the lawsuit argues the state law violates the First Amendment right to free speech of Iowa's LGBTQ students and asks the court to find the entire law unconstitutional. The students are identified in the lawsuit only by initials, but some chose to speak Tuesday at a news conference hosted by the ACLU of Iowa. Like it or not, sex and sexuality are part of the teenage experience. Refusing to provide adolescents with information about it means they'll seek out their own information from the internet or from others in ways that are significantly less safe than books reviewed by teachers and librarians, Puck Carlson, a senior from Iowa City who is one of the 7 student plaintiffs, said Tuesday in a statement read during an online news conference. Removing books that discuss queer topics of people from schools tells our creative students that they do not belong there, that they are shameful. I am not shameful. The federal lawsuit was filed in the Southern District of Iowa. The ACLU of Iowa, Lambda Legal, and the law firm Jenner and Block are representing the 7 students and Iowa Safe Schools, a nonprofit that advocates for LGBTQ students in Iowa. The state law is a clear violation of public school students' First Amendment rights to speak, learn, and read freely, ACLU of Iowa lawyer Thomas Story said during the news conference. The First Amendment does not allow our state or our schools to remove books or issue blanket bans on discussion and material simply because a group of politicians or parents find them offensive. A similar law in Florida was unsuccessfully challenged in federal court there. Lawyers representing the plaintiffs in Iowa said they believe the outcome will be different here. They pointed to other cases in other states where courts did intervene, but the cases they noted involved higher education or public libraries, not K-12 schools. We are committed to continuing to challenge any restriction on student speech wherever they appear. These latest attacks are just another chapter, said Nathan Maxwell, a senior attorney with Lambda Legal, which is helping to represent the plaintiffs. We think that the Iowa law is so clearly unconstitutional as it's written and as it's applied, and we're very confident in our case. We expect the court to agree with us. Iowa State House Republican leaders issued a statement Tuesday defending the new state law that they passed, with some of them arguing that pornography should not be in Iowa's schools. The new law does not actually ban pornography. It bans books or curriculums that describe sexual acts. That has led some schools to remove from their libraries some books that contain depictions of sexual acts, including classics like To Kill a Mockingbird and 1984, plus books with LGBTQ themes or by LGBTQ authors that contain passages describing sexual acts. The law exempts religious texts, including the Bible. Protecting children from pornography and sexually explicit content shouldn't be controversial. The real controversy is that it exists in elementary schools, Reynolds said in a statement. Books with graphic depictions of sex acts have absolutely no places in our schools. If these books were movies, they'd be rated R, said Republican Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker in a statement. The state of Iowa has a legitimate interest in protecting elementary school children from being provided pornography in taxpayer-funded schools. Senate File 496 put parents first in the education of their children, and Senate Republicans will continue to advance policies to empower parents so Iowa students receive the best education in the country, added Republican Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley in a statement. House Republicans stand behind the law that overwhelmingly passed our chamber. The sexualization of children in schools does not have a place in Iowa. This is a responsible and reasonable law that I believe all Iowans could get behind if the far left and the media would stop playing politics and actually represent what is actually in the law. Reynolds joined Grassley in criticizing media outlets for their coverage of the topic. The new law went into effect this summer, and enforcement is scheduled to begin January 1st. The Iowa Board of Education recently advanced new state rules for implementation of the law. Education groups criticized the proposed rules in the way that they did the law itself as being too vague. And there is one story with this. There's one picture with this story, and it is of a young teenager sitting on the couch with a mom and a dad. The caption says, Plaintiff family Richard Puck and Ulrich Carlson of Iowa City. Next up is a story written by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. The headline is, Crop Harvest is Virtually Complete in Iowa. Nearly all of Iowa's corn and soybean fields have been harvested, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's final crop update about the state this year. Corn harvested for grain is virtually complete, with farmers in the southern part of the state still running a few combines, the USDA said in its Monday report. The soybean harvest finished about 2 weeks ago. Both crop harvests concluded more than a week ahead of the five-year average, in part because late summer heat and drought conditions led the crops to mature earlier. The USDA predicted this month that Iowa corn yields will average about 200 bushels per acre, despite persistent drought conditions, and that soybean yields will average about 58 bushels per acre. That roughly matches the actual production reported for last year. The USDA estimates that about 33% of the state's topsoil and 27% of its subsoil has adequate moisture for growing crops headed into winter, when frozen grounds limit water absorption. The frost depth in some parts of Iowa was 3 inches on Monday, according to the National Weather Service. Dry conditions across most of Iowa have been largely static in recent weeks, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. About 84% of the state is suffering from some measure of drought, and about half of eastern Iowa has extreme drought, the second to worst of four classifications. Those conditions are expected to persist until at least the end of February, according to the Federal Climate Prediction Center. You're listening to Iris, the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Morgan from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Morgan from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. And now we'll go on to today's obituaries. The first obituary is for Jim Wrinkle, who lived from February 12, 1952 to November 25, 2023. James E. Wrinkle, age 72, passed away on November 25, 2023 in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim was born to the late Robert E. Wrinkle and Gloria L. Wrinkle on February 12, 1952, in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School with the class of 1970. Jim worked for Communications Workers of America, District 7 in Omaha, Nebraska, Environmental Salvage, as a supervisor and instructor until their closing. Jim then decided in 1991 to start his own business, BBW Environmental, for over 25 years until his retirement. In addition to his parents, Jim was preceded in death by his brothers Jeffrey Wrinkle, John May Jr., in-laws Earl and Maxine Gibbs, second mother Mary Lou Wrinkle, former in-laws Earl and Thea Williamson. Survivors include his wife of 31 years, Patricia, sons Brian Wrinkle of Lawrence, Kansas, Brent Wrinkle of Hickman, Nebraska, Kurt Holmes of Council Bluffs, daughter Julie Camp of Fort Myers, Florida, grandsons Eric Camp of St. Petersburg, Florida, and Jason Camp of Sarasota, granddaughters Chloe Wrinkle of Hampton and Gemma Hansen of Hickman, brother Raymond Wrinkle of Crescent, sisters Johnny Kelso of Omaha and Jenny Wrinkle of California, former spouse Rwanda Wrinkle of Omaha, Nebraska, many nieces, nephews, and friends. Visitation with the family Thursday, 6 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Wu during Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Friday, 11 a.m. at the funeral home. A lunch will follow at Denny's Place in Crescent, Iowa. Memorials are suggested to Midlands Humane Society or a charity of your choice. The next obituary is for Nazarino, or Mike, D'Angelo, who lived from February 22, 1942 to November 25, 2023. Nazarino D'Angelo, affectionately known as Mike to his friends, was born February 22, 1942 in Vibo Valentina, Calabria, Italy, to Francesco and Elisabetta D'Angelo. Nazarino's life was a remarkable journey that left an indelible mark on the lives of those fortunate enough to know him. Nazarino departed this world peacefully, surrounded by the warmth of his beloved family, on November 25, 2023. Nazarino is survived by his wife, Anna, his three accomplished children, along with their spouses, Adriana and Emily, and his seven cherished grandchildren. In addition, his brother, Antonio D'Angelo, and sisters-in-law Antonina D'Angelo, Rose D'Angelo, and Adelina D'Angelo. In honoring Nazarino's memory, in lieu of flowers, the family kindly requests that memorial contributions be directed to Our Lady of Peace Hospice in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he received tender care in his final days. Donations can be made at www.ourladyofpeacemn.org/donate. May Nazarino D'Angelo rest in eternal peace, his legacy echoing through the lives he touched and the communities he enriched. A mass of Christian burial will take place on Saturday, December 2nd, 2023 at 11 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Avoca, Iowa. Visitation with the family will be at the church starting at 9 a.m. until the time of the service. Interment will be in Oakland Cemetery at Oakland, Iowa at 1:30 p.m. Riken Veith Funeral Home in Oakland is assisting the family. Next is Helen E. Sousa, and that last name is spelled S-O-U-S-A, who lived from June 3, 1939 to November 22, 2023. Helen E. Sousa, age 87 of Council Bluffs, passed away November 22, 2023 at Country House in Council Bluffs. Helen was born June 3, 1936 in Council Bluffs to the late Bernadina, Ben, and Catherine, Kate, Espinosa. She graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1954. Helen worked for Northwestern Bell for 30-plus years, retiring in 1990. She was a member of Our Guadalupe Catholic Church in Omaha and a member of the Guadalupanas Rosary Society. In addition to her parents, Ellen was preceded in death by 12 of her siblings. Helen is survived by her daughters, Jamie Sousa and husband Dan Driscoll, Marcia Sousa, Bernadette Sousa, all of Council Bluffs, son John Sousa Jr. of Providence, Rhode Island, three grandchildren, Grace Taylor and Anthony Sousa, and a host of other family and many friends. Recitation of the Rosary, Monday, December 4th, 2023 at 6 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Wu during Bayless Park Chapel. Mass of Christian Burial, Tuesday, December 5th, 2023, at 10 a.m. at Corpus Christi Queen of the Apostles Catholic Church, Council Bluffs. Interment, Memorial Park Cemetery, with a lunch following at the church. The family will direct memorial contributions. The next piece is Fern Ann Snipes, who lived from November 3rd, 1929 to November 27th, 2023. Fern Ann Snipes, age 94, passed away November 27th, 2023 at Fox Run. Fern was born in Council Bluffs on November 3rd, 1929 to the late Frank and Meta Boardman. She attended Thomas Jefferson High School and was united in marriage to Albert Snipes on April 5, 1950. During her working career, Fern worked at Campbell Soup, retiring in 1992 after 26 years of service, and Walmart from 1992 to 2020, retiring at the age of 90. Fern was a lifelong and active member of Timothy Lutheran Church. In addition to her parents, Fern is preceded in death by her husband Albert in 2008, daughter Sally, granddaughter Heather Britton, siblings Natalie, Joanne, Betty Lou, Arlene, Ken, and Franklin. Fern is survived by her sons, Daryl Snipes of Council Bluffs, Patrick Snipes, Daniel Snipes, all of York, Nebraska, nine grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, one great-great-grandchild, brother, and sister-in-law. Visitation will be Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Funeral service Saturday, 11 a.m. at Timothy Lutheran Church. Interment in Ridgewood Cemetery with a luncheon to follow at Timothy Lutheran Church Social Hall. Memorials to Timothy Lutheran Church or a charity of your choice. Dorothy Jean Wright, who lived from November 14, 1929 to November 27, 2023. Dorothy Jean Wright, age 94, passed away November 27, 2023 in Council Bluffs. Dorothy was born November 14, 1929 in Crescent, Iowa, to the late Clarence and the Da Oamek. And that is spelled the word the and then D-A and then a space. O-A-M-E-K. She grew up on the farm and loved tending to her chickens, canning, working in her garden, and spending time with family and friends. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, Roland, brothers, Novin Oamek and Orville Buzz Oamek, daughter, Sandra Dietrich, She's survived by son, James Wright, daughter, Patricia Piper, grandchildren, Mark, Sarah, Kimberly, 5 great-grandchildren, sons-in-law, Bob Daytrick and Alan Piper, many nieces, nephews, cousins, and friends. She was loved by all and will be greatly missed. No services will be held. Phyllis D. Brennan, with the maiden name Madsen, who lived from December 16th, 1929 to November 28th, 2023. The visitation will be from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m., December 1st, 2023, at 7805 West Central Road. Vigil following at 6:30 p.m., Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m., December 2nd, 2023, at Corpus Christi / Queen of Apostles Church at 3304 4th Avenue, Council Bluffs. Memorials will be directed by the family. That was our final obituary. I will now be moving on to the sports section. The first story is titled Lynx Scrap By Rams, Girls Basketball High School. And this is written by Austin Heinen of the Nonpareil. The Abraham Lincoln Lynx won their home opener, fending off a late Glenwood rally to improve to 2-0 with a 53-47 win on Tuesday night in Council Bluffs. With both teams starting with a full court press, points were hard to come by in the first quarter, but with different Lynx players finding the score sheet early, the Lynx clawed it out to a 9-7 lead after the first. You got to give a lot of credit to Glenwood. They really showed right away that they were going to come out and give you everything they've got, Lynx coach Chad Shaw said. Fortunately, we got them in game number one, but it was nice to see our younger team have that resilience and fight back with them each time they got on a run. The offenses started to decode their opponents in the second quarter, but it was the Rams making the first move early in the second quarter with a 10-3 run, partially fueled by back-to-back baskets in the paint from Maggie Smith and Danica Arnold. However, the Lynx immediately answered with a 12-4 run to close the quarter. On some of our plays, we've really been working on trying to get into the paint, Lynx sophomore Addie Naughton said. Once we started figuring some things out, we got some easy looks. The Lynx went on an early 7-2 run in the third quarter and eventually took an 11-point lead heading into the fourth quarter. The Rams wasted no time in trimming the deficit as 2 threes from senior Lauren Hughes helped fuel the team and brought the Rams within just a point midway through the quarter. However, despite their hot run in the fourth quarter, the Rams were held to just 3 points in the final 5 minutes of the contest. The late baskets by Audrey Sanbooth and Addie Naughton helped the Lynx stump the Rams' rally attempt. We just kept working as a team, and some girls came off the bench and really helped us keep going, Sanbooth said. We really worked through tough spots and worked together. Defensively, we stayed aggressive, and I can tell we really slowed them down. Naughton led the Lynx with 13 points, and Sanbooth added another 10 for the Lynx. Lauren Hughes led Glenwood with 12 points. There are a few images with this story, and they are all of girls playing basketball in the game. The next story is Boys Basketball High School. Thomas Jefferson swarms Glenwood early, holds off rally. Written by Peter Burnett of the Nonpareil. A barrage of early threes and strong defense helped Thomas Jefferson hold off a late Glenwood rally for a 66-62 season opening win on Tuesday, November 28th. I think just getting locked in before and staying focused gave us confidence, said Yellow Jackets senior forward Jaden DeWally, who finished with 17 points and 4 made threes. I'd say a lot of it is off-season work, a lot of things I do before the game. We had a nice hour and a half shoot around before. I also had a bad shooting night last year against Glenwood, so I felt I needed to overcome this season and prove what I can do. TJ opened the game shooting 6-for-11 from 3 to pull ahead to 22-15 after the first quarter. Head coach Donnie Johnson said getting early shots and creating space by pushing the ball up the court generate offense. Early good shots because we were getting wide open shots. Johnson said. They were falling so they can go back to the well when they're falling. The Rams, meanwhile, started just 1 for 6 from the free throw line and struggled to get points from the charity stripe. I mean, they're a good ball club, Glunson head coach Kurt Schutte said. They shot the ball well, and our approach was to get the ball down low. We wanted to get to the free throw line, and we're happy that we got there as many times as we did. We just got to do a better job of converting once we get there. Diwali knocked down his 4th three-pointer of the game midway through the second quarter. Jackson Lincoln transfer Jaden Calabro scored 11 points in the opening half and finished with 18 to lead TJ. The variety of scoring options, Devin Davis Conti, 14, paired with Diwali's scoring and rebounding and strong team defense, propelled the Jackets. The Jackets' lead was cut to 6 at the end of the third, and Glenwood eventually trimmed it down to 3 halfway through the fourth quarter. Caden Anderson led with 17 points, while Casey Godbout and Aiden Gibson, off the bench, scored 16 each, leaving Schulte excited for this season, in spite of the effort falling short. "We're really excited about what we have, the pieces we have," Schulte said. For Johnson and the Jackets, being able to hold a 4-point win is a big difference from last year. "We always wanted to get off on a good start, and it's positive," Johnson said. The next article is titled AL's Romano, LC's Strohmeyer, and Larson Earn All-State First Team Honors, written by Peter Burnett of the Nonpareil. Abraham Lincoln Sr., Molly Romero, and Lewis Central Sr., Anna Strohmeyer, and Junior Brooke Larson were named to the 5A and 4A All-State First Teams, respectively. Romano and Strohmeyer both played in the Senior All-Star Classic in Johnston, Iowa, on Saturday, November 11th. Romano finished with 896 assists for the Lynx. Strohmeyer had 232 kills. Larson, meanwhile, provided versatility for the Titans. Addison Holt, senior libero, was selected to the 4A second team, holding together the LC back line, while Ashleen Haverman made the third team. Glenwood's Charlie Hernandez was also selected to the 4A, a third team. In 2A, Underwood's Elizabeth Jacobson and trainers Aubrey James were selected to the fourth team. St. Albert's Ellie Monahan made the 1A first team, while Riverside's Ayla Richardson made the fourth team. The Nonpareil's All-City team and Player of the Year selections will be published next week. Oh, that's exciting. Moving on to some lighter news regarding Council Bluffs, I will read an article that is titled Harvester Artist Lofts Bringing Back Boutique for Holiday Gifts. The Harvester Artist Lofts is bringing back its holiday boutique this Saturday and Sunday. After several years of hiatus due to the pandemic, Harvester resident artists and local artists are coming together to offer handmade gifts for the holiday season. Over 25 local handmade vendors will be selling a variety of gifts at 1000 South Main Street. Sales will be 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Saturday and 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday. Vendors will be based on all four floors of the Harvester. The event is free for the public to attend. Holiday gifts available at the boutique include homemade soaps, candles, stickers, baked goods, alpaca yarn and goods, ornaments, jewelry, clothing, and original arts. The next story is titled Christmas Tree Tour Backs Midlands Humane Society. Julia Burris's annual Christmas Tree Tour returns for a 15th year this December. The event features 28 themed Christmas trees and an ornament scavenger hunt at the home of Dale and Julia Burris, 24336 Richfield Loop in Council Bluffs, from 1 to 4 p.m. on Sunday, December 3rd and Sunday, December 10th. Burris originally participated in the Trainer Junior Women's League Holiday Home Tour, growing her own event from there. Each year, she changes things up by adding new ornaments, rotating out different trees, and putting up new displays. "It's really different this year. I'm excited," Burris said. They have added 6 new trees and have updated some of the old ones. "We redid our cartoon and Disney trees, and I've made a new tree based off of Alice in Wonderland," she said. "There's a really neat tree in the hallway upstairs. It's going to be kind of a surprise, and my bedroom is all greens this year. Last year it was pinks." Tour cost is $5 per person or $10 per family. All proceeds will be donated to Midlands Humane Society. The Burrises choose a different cause to benefit each year. During the 2022 event, someone from Midlands Humane Society approached Burris, asking if she would donate a private tour of the event as an auction item for the shelter's annual gala. She obliged, also selecting MHS as the beneficiary of this year's proceeds. The auction item won $1,200 for the Humane Society. She hopes to get the word out to other organizations that may want to offer a similar auction item in the future, which would help diversify the number of causes the Burrises can help. "It had a lot of interest. I was shocked," Burris said. "It all fell into place once they approached me with that idea." The next story is about Winter Jam Brings Christian Music's Biggest Tour to Mac by Scott Stewart of the Nonpareil. The biggest traveling tour of Christian music plans to make a stop in Council Bluffs on Thursday, February 1st. Winter Jam was founded more than 2 decades ago by the Christian music group New Song, and the 2024 tour will kick off January 12th in Mobile, Alabama, before traveling to 38 other communities. This year's Winter Jam will feature first-time tour performers, including Kane, Katie Nicholl, Seventh Day Slumber, and Joseph O'Brien, along with featured performers Crowders, Lecrae, Katie Nicholl, and New Song. "I can't wait to be out on Winter Jam again. It's a special thing, and there's nothing else like it. I'm honored to be a part," Crowder said in a news release. "The lineup this year looks incredible. Some of my favorite folks will be there, and I am beyond excited to be back out singing to God together. It's going to be a great tour." Crowder is a Grammy-nominated artist who will perform hits from his current album, Milk and Honey, including his number one Billboard hot gospel song, God Really Loves Us, along with other chart toppers, including Great Good God Almighty, In the House, All My Hope, and Come As You Are. The award-winning sibling trio, Kane, will perform their number one back-to-back radio hits, Rise Up and Yes He Can, both songs from their first full-length album, Rise Up, along with hits from their worshiping project. Lecrae, a Grammy Award-winning artist that blends faith with hip-hop, will perform current hits from his current chart-topping album, Church Clothes for Deluxe. Nicholl, who is the Dove Awards New Artist of the Year, will perform songs from her debut album, Jesus Changed My Life. After being featured on America's Got Talent, O'Brien will perform his new single, Give Up on Love, as well as Take Your Time and Down on My Heart. Eddie Carswell of New Song said the 2024 tour is one of my favorite lineups we've ever been able to have. "I love having some new faces as well as old friends. I can't wait to see all the lives that will be changed." No tickets are needed for the February 1st show at the Mid-American Center. Admission is a $15 donation at the door. A pre-jam party with SEU Worship, John Wesley, and Lynn D is planned. Find details at jamtour.com. Lastly, there's an article written by Scott Stewart of the Nonpareil titled "Register to Dine with Santa at Dodge House this Saturday. It's last call to get on Santa's list. Not the all-important naughty or nice lists or whatever surveillance report Elf on the Shelf is passing along to the North Pole Intelligence Service. It's the deadline to sign up to visit with Santa at the historic General Dodge House. Registration closes Thursday for the Saturday morning breakfast with Santa events. 2 seating times are available, 10 a.m. and 11:30 a.m., and guests are asked to show up on time for their reserved breakfast time. The cost is $15 per person. Children 2 and under are free but still require advanced registration. All sales are final. The visits include hot cocoa with breakfast, along with a reading of The Night Before Christmas, and holiday-themed craft making. The holiday tradition is presented by the General's Ladies. Find more information or register at dodgehouse.org. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 30th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Morgan from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing. It really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.